All right, so we're continuing on with our discussions with YAL 2012 speakers. We're with Kevlin Henney. Thanks for coming on Channel 9.
That's a pleasure.
So you did one of the keynotes here, and it's titled Cool Code, which is a great name.
Yeah, that's part of the reason I chose it. Yeah. Simple two-word title, yeah.
Excellent. Tell us a little bit about your keynote.
It's basically cool code examples that are unusual in some way. They're not directly educational. They're not intended to be how-tos, directly instructive, things you can use at work. They're none of these things. They are historical or profound in some way. Either they make you sit there and go, you can't do that. Is that even possible? Mm-hmm. Or they're entertaining. So there's lots of examples that are very, very small. You kind of look at that and say, how can you express that much logic, that much program in that little space or that little code? Mm-hmm. Or they're historically significant. I mean, one of the examples I use is the code from Apollo 11, lunar landing code. And you can get that on Google Code and you can go through it. And you know, there's a whole story. So I've got code fragments from the 1960s all the way up to the present day. Mm. And there's examples that are just playful and humorous because I don't think we spend enough time having fun.
Sure.
When people are working at the code phase. So I've got a real range of stuff right across different programming languages that are instructive either directly or indirectly in the sense of just showing you what's possible and showing you that actually there's more than working on the code base you're working on at the moment. There's fun or ingenuity to be had. And I think that's really the best feedback I get from that talk is when people sort of tell me that, or even better, they give me extra examples for future runs of the course. Yeah.
Excellent. So what do you make of sort of where we are today with this, you know, essentially unlimited memory? I mean, if you look at the desktop kind of world as a developer, you have all this memory and you could build these gigantic applications with really large virtual machines underneath them. Mm. I mean, what's your take on how the modern developer couldn't write a chess game, as you show, in 1K?
I think that the meta principle is important because every time we think we've increased the bandwidth, we've increased the memory, we've increased the processing speed, and so therefore the principles of being able to sort of shoehorn a piece of code into a small space are no longer relevant, we fill up that capacity. We find something new to do with it. Mm-hmm. These days, download speed is the threshold. You can't cheat the speed of light. We're going to hit that one. We tried cheating the speed of light last year. That didn't work out too well. And the point is that we hit some of these limits. If you allow me to download something twice as fast as I could before, then I will download twice as much. In fact, I'll probably want to download three or four times as much. I will use up that spare capacity. Mm. And we're seeing it with data centers as well, that actually the efficiency issues, when you're running thousands upon thousands of machines, it turns out that an optimized algorithm will actually ultimately cause the destruction of fewer trees than an unoptimized one. You know, so all of these things still have implications. They're not exactly the same as they were. Like the Apollo code, we're not having to shoehorn a rocket operating system into something that has less memory than my watch, but the principles are still there. We still, wherever we have a limit, we find a need to exceed it and therefore have to be ingenious within that limit. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's going to change until we lose imagination. I don't think that's going to change.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned efficiency, and one of the things we always talk about is performance. And what's the relationship between efficiency and performance?
That's a very good question. I think efficiency is, if we look at performance as being the utilization of resources, one of which is time, another of which is system resources such as memory, that's in its broadest sense, then efficiency is a term that we would apply in that context. When we talk about performance, then efficiency is we are saying something about a performance characteristic where we have basically tuned it. We have got the most out of it that we possibly can in that sense. And so we would refer to that as being efficient in that context. So it's slightly contextual. In other words, to say that something is efficient, we normally need to know what the question is before we can say, that is efficient, that is inefficient. Yeah. For some people, space is important, other people, time is important. In other cases, it's bandwidth usage and so on. You kind of have to know what the question is before you can declare the answer as being efficient.
Sure. So when I look at like what we have today in our PCs and whatnot, the for example, the Ivy Bridge processor, 2 billion transistors, you have a GPU and a CPU on the same die, they share memory. How do modern programmers really get to exploit that amount of power? In some sense, that's really my question. So hardware is moving very, very fast.
Yeah.
And software really is struggling to catch up. I mean, compilers do rocket science to auto-vectorize stuff, for example, the back-end compiler guys. C++, you know, we get that for free in modern compilers.
Well, I think that's where you have to rely on, what you have to rely on, where you have to place the effort and the emphasis is on compilers and the tools, because hardware has been romping ahead. On the other hand, let's put it another way. The primitives are still the same. It's still based on transistors. You still list that out as being the basic primitive. Just got better at making them smaller. The problem with software development is that the scale of what is being constructed you're not putting together a bunch of transistors. You're putting together a bunch of connectives, Boolean connectives. You're putting together control flow. You're creating this vast, complex system. So the software gets bigger. It basically eventually capsizes under its own complexity. So most of the time, software developers are dealing with the complexity of the very act of creating software. And then you throw an extra thing at them. Could you make it fast? Could you use less memory? Could you do this, that, and the other? This execution quality needs to be improved. That's an extra challenge, and to get the most out of these things, I think the last time we could do that was quite a while ago. If you were to hand craft it, the minute instruction pipelining came in, that's it, kind of game over for the intuitive use of the underlying hardware. We have to rely so much on the intermediate tools. So it's really that kind of layered model to get the most out of it. Of course, we learn certain things. We need to learn more about hardware, but it's more hardware appreciation. There's so many layers and so many things going on. It's an almost chaotic system. You do have to lean an awful lot more on the intermediate tools and intermediate layers.
Absolutely. Now, you in your talk, you go from talking to you about listening to what you had talked about. You have example in assembler, and then you have sort of the more traditional languages. I mean, in reality, because you're also a consultant, right? So you help spectrum of customers. Some are going to be native, some are going to be managed. Kind of take me through a little bit about how you're seeing people using the right tool for the job.
What I'm seeing is there, obviously I'm a small data point in a very large pond. What I'm seeing is seems to be a sort of a better separation. I think people have become a little more open to the idea of openness. So for example, if I look at folks working in the Java space, 10 years ago, the Java agenda was defined by Sun. 10 years on, Sun doesn't exist, but the Java agenda is not being dictated by Oracle. It is being dictated by people creating open source code. That was not entirely acceptable in the late 90s as a perspective. When people talk about C and C++, half the time they're referring to open tools. And so there's this idea that it's okay to use this stuff. And therefore, there's more that people can draw from. So whilst in some cases I would say that people should look around a little more than they do, they are looking around a little more than they did. And this kind of has led to a bit of a settling out. It doesn't mean everybody is using the right thing, but I've noticed in my own work, for example, there's been a sort of a separation in terms of what people are trying to do. So in terms of the C and C++ stuff, the people that I see, the people that I teach and consult for that are using C and C++ are doing so for largely the right reasons. They are kind of hugging the metal. They're trying to do something with it that is impractical in using other tools, typically. And they're not just dealing with some legacy UI application that would, quite frankly, be better written in almost any other technology than C or C++. Whereas 10 years ago, I've seen people just collapsing under their own weight of the misuse of these languages to do these jobs. Java seems to sort of have a very sort of sweet spot in the enterprise space, although not always positive. It's there. So when I deal with people doing Java-based work, they tend to be focused in, they're all kind of doing web stuff or larger enterprisey frameworky type stuff.
Okay.
And there, for them, I tend to focus less on the underlying guts, although I certainly give code review comments. It tends to be more on the development techniques and so on. And I'd say that C Sharp and its kin are in that kind of space as well. I'm seeing that. Although I'm seeing, obviously, there's a lot of other shifts here and there. And sometimes people ask me in where they're using a programming language I'm relatively unfamiliar with, completely unfamiliar with, or just a tourist in. Mm. And what I'm talking about there typically is either a bigger architectural thing or helping them out with development techniques. So there's a real range, but people do seem to be a little bit better at sizing or being aware of the fact that there is a choice, which is gratifying, because otherwise half the time you spend just beating your head against a brick wall.
Sure.
You know, you're using the wrong tool, but you've got a legacy of it. I would say that I think I'm seeing that with some of the C# and Java stuff that's kicking around these days. I think there are better ways of doing that, but it's better than it could be. I'll put it like that.
Cool. So for the, you know, the C++ people, and so I guess we, you know, the native developers, to use the term, how are you seeing them? You know, when you think about the history of that language, it sort of has a lot of this baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's some sort of, there's in some sense a renaissance in the sense that if you look at C++ 11, it seems to be a modernized language. It feels different. It looks different.
Yeah.
How is that impacting like the C++ developers that you work with? I mean, are they excited about that or do they feel?
Some are excited. Some are annoyed. Some are unaware. But those who are annoyed are typically constrained by something on their platform. If you're doing, say, for example, games developers or a lot of embedded or real-time related work, there's a lot of goodies they can't get their hands on. Mm. And these are not necessarily goodies that would fatten up an executable. They are just things that would be more expressive for everything that they're doing. But the problem is, it's difficult to just say, I'll take that piece of the language and not get all the others, which does come with a certain cost and a size and a certain maintenance. Somebody has to deal with the compiler side of things. Mm. So some people are embracing it. So a lot of C++ 11 features kind of make good on some of the promises of kind of the earlier STL work in C++ 98, which is, in that sense, you can do a better job of doing functional style programming and much more expressive programming. Mm-hmm. So you end up with a compactness of form that you just didn't get previously. So the idea you can write something that's compact, direct, and you can even throw the word elegant in occasionally, though don't overuse it, but it is that you have that idea there. That's appealing. It allows people to get rid of a lot more boilerplate code, and I don't think you should ever underestimate how much noise in code will discourage people from either engaging that code, maintaining that code, adding to it, or what have you.
Sure.
So I think that there is that, and so some people are just absolutely lapping that up. It's exactly what they needed, but for other people, it's just yet another update that they can't afford in their environment because they're still programming in a C++ that I, you know, long ceased to recognize that's nearly two decades old. You know, it feels very retro in some ways.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, you're missing standard libraries and a number of other features, sometimes for good reason, often not quite as sound a reason as people would make out.
Certainly. And so what are some of the, you know, functional programming is certainly something that's kind of goes in and out of fashion. It seems to be in fashion again.
Yeah, I think that it's kind of, its time has sort of come. It's like the tide coming in. Each kind of wave comes up a little bit further. And this time, it's quite good, although a lot of people are misrecognizing features and saying, oh, they're doing functional programming, whereas its features have been around in even procedural and object-oriented languages since the 60s. The idea of being able to pass pieces of code to other pieces of code to execute them is not a new idea. So for whatever reason, fell out of fashion in the late 60s. But originally, ALGOL 60, which is a grandparent of C, allowed you to pass a block of code just to something else. And for whatever reason, that just didn't make it through to a lot of languages. And it turns out to be surprisingly useful. So people have got very excited about really quite trivial things like lambdas. Mm. I only say they're trivial because we knew how to do them. We knew that they were not a problem years ago. They're not trivial in the sense that they allow you an economy of expression and a simplicity of expressing certain ideas. But there's a whole bunch of other stuff that's become popular. Sometimes people are targeting it for reasons of efficiency. At other times, it's the shape of the problem. There are loads of examples of software where people are just taking data in, doing a whole lot of stuff, and then emitting a transformed version of the data out. And they're putting an awful lot of effort into doing that. And this I see a lot. And they're creating lots of intermediate object representations, very sophisticated object models. And sometimes, quite frankly, it's just not necessary. It really is a data transformation problem, and that would be a better tool. So I think it's appropriate. I don't think it's going to be a displacement in the sense that object orientation was a major displacement of a number of things that came before it. I think going back to the point I said earlier about the greater acceptance of diversity and the openness, it's going to be a side-by-side affair rather than a pushing-out affair. But I think that is healthy. It goes back to Robert Floyd's paper, Paradigms of Programming. He's the guy we can all blame for introducing the paradigms word to software. it was 1979, and he in his Turing Award paper, he talked about this, and he said he made an observation. He said we don't have enough paradigms. He was making a case, not that people get locked into one, but that they think very clearly about the nature of the problem and the kind of tool that they want to fit it. And so he's actually making a case for, I guess what we would now call, most of the time, we would now call patterns and pattern languages. He's actually making a case, this is his view of paradigm, is a problem-solving technique, a frame for thinking, sometimes within a language or sometimes to choose a language to solve this. And I think we're kind of realizing that one on, and over 3 decades on, we're kind of realizing that maybe that's the way to go. So I think functional programming side is very exciting because those ideas have matured kind of in the background. They've been there a lot, but somehow until the Fortran and COBOL and C view of the universe, the kind of 70s, 80s, 90s, was able to be kind of kicked in some meaningful way, that really wasn't going to get in. It couldn't present itself the same way that objects did at the time, the rise of graphical systems, for example, and growing complexity, the greater need for modularity. Objects were kind of the right tool at the right time. And also there was a lot more compromise in that discipline as well. C++ has been a really good example. It's one of the things that helped transition people in. Not always in the right way. A lot of people found that it wasn't the language for them. They were solving the wrong problem.
Yeah.
But by taking an existing language, C, which had a wealth of libraries that you could build on, rather than trying to reinvent the wheel, people kept coming up with new and fashionable ways of reusing stuff, but they didn't have anything they could reuse. Whereas Bjarne Strastrup's perspective is there's all this stuff written in C, all these fundamental facilities in C. Let's build a language that is close enough to take advantage of them. That didn't happen the same way for functional programming. It came from a direction of purity. So it didn't quite hit the mainstream in the way, broadside, in the way that objects were able to. But I think we've kind of all loosened up a little bit, and via different means, via scripting, via a technical push, the need for, if you want better concurrency, then more locking is not the way to do it. You want transparent scaling, you need immutability, you need non-sharing, you need all of these techniques, most of which you get for free in some functional perspective of the world. And so there's a kind of a natural home for it there. So it's many things at the same time that have kind of helped encourage that into the sort of flirt at the edge of the mainstream and influence language design and programmer thinking.
So, speaking of, mainstream languages, I mean, what's your take on this JavaScript revolution that we seem to be having? I mean, here's a language that was developed in 2 weeks, it's full of warts, and potentially because of the way it was designed, it's so dynamic. You're using objects, but you might not realize they're objects. Everything's an object in JavaScript, right?
Yeah.
So what's your take on because coming from like the language side where you have this beautiful design language and lots of effort and thought, and here we have this scripting language that's now sort of dominating the world.
Yeah. A couple of things. One is that it's always very instructive to look at how things actually become popular. And JavaScript, a number of things have helped it, one of which is quite simply availability. It's available on every machine that connects to the internet. It's there, it's in your browser. that idea is that in some ways, although a little different, it's ended up being the basic that you found in home computers, but more portable. Even though it has its portability issues, it's there. Kids can mess about with it and can do stuff with it. They won't do anything profound necessarily, but a lot of them will just sort of say, well, I've got this page and I want a little bit of behavior, and then they start drawing that in, and it's available, and they can do everything. There's all these libraries written in this stuff. They can get access to it. So there's this kind of ecosystem that's sort of built up around it. But the other side, obviously, is the efficiency side, and the fact that lots of vendors, so you have the execution side of it. It is efficient. When people started pushing to get their VMs going faster, basically, let's not just merely interpret it. Let's actually have an efficient JavaScript engine and make that a selling point, a reason that people want to use our browser rather than somebody else's browser, something that makes somebody's online experience quantifiably different and allows them to plug into the ecosystem without resenting it and saying, this is a slow website, it's unresponsive, what have you. So you kind of ended up with this sort of virtuous cycle. It's nothing to do with the intrinsic, necessarily to do with the intrinsic virtues of the language. It's mostly environmental. It's the right situation, the right time. And it was this idea. It was just available, and there it was. In theory, that could have happened to any language, but they just weren't there. It's as simple as that. So there's been this effort put into this to work around the inefficiencies of the language, to work around the warts or appreciate the warts. And so people now know this stuff. It is one of the most widely used languages.
Absolutely.
it still makes me twinge every now and then. But it's there in that is very much it is, as I said, instructive to learn what makes a language popular, or what makes these ideas take off. And there is a lot of compromise and opportunity that lead to that.
Absolutely. And I mean, if you look at even with sort of Windows 8, you can build client applications in JavaScript and HTML5.
Yeah, and so you reach this convergence where actually it's ultimately become kind of the driver. It's an accepted part of it. This is the future of the web, and also the future more generally of applications. And it was just in there. And then, and there are a number of other languages that are kind of compete for a little bit of that space, but. They're a long way behind.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. So, many languages, right? I mean, given your history and what you do for a living, do you have a favorite language? Do you try to keep yourself away from saying, I'm a this developer, I'm a that developer, and this is, what is your go-to tool? Do you have one?
I'm going to say that I probably don't. I kind of have accepted, I've sort of stepped back from the battleground that is the programming language battleground for a lot of the time, because every time I think I like something in one language, I find that it's likable in another language, or it's better in another language, or there's something else in another language that is attractive. And I see people doing smart things with lots of different languages, so I feel less likely to wade in on a specific language's behalf, although I may playfully joke about it, disliking certain languages, and there are some languages that I'm not about to sit down and learn, but I just see so many programming languages around that for a lot of them, if we say I know, I mean, basically I'm a tourist in a lot of languages. I think that I'm kind of reluctant to sort of pick on a specific language unless I were given a specific problem.
Sure.
I don't have. I'm kind of not saying I have any particular favourites at the moment, but. The favourite might change on a minute-to-minute basis. Occasionally, I will sort of prod myself to do something slightly ridiculous. in fact, it was a good fun example. I did a talk last year with Anders Norris in Oslo, and we had done this. We decided to do this joint talk, and we decided to do use each programming language in the talk no more than once. Which meant that we started digging around for other languages we could express certain functional programming ideas in. And I found myself messing about with some PowerShell. I'd messed about with PowerShell before very briefly, but I went at it with a little more interest this time, and I was very surprised by it. I'm not about to say that that's the tool I would go to, but I found there's a lot of design ideas there that were very crisply done and very surprising, having looked at sort of regards less well-designed areas of .NET, or less well-thought-out .NET translations of programming languages. I thought I was very surprised by some of the ideas that went on there. So that was fun. That kept me happy for one journey, just going into all the stuff and reading through it and learning about it in a way I hadn't really given myself the opportunity to do before, and just solve a couple of very toy problems. But I kind of do that a little bit with different languages, but that's not the same as necessarily helping people out with a larger system.
Sure. Well, Jefferson Over would be happy to hear this, right? PowerShell. PowerShell is really an interesting language for sure.
It is, yeah.
And it has pretty widespread use in Windows, you know.
Yes.
So as sort of the default mechanisms that, you know, runs sort of when a wizard runs, it's actually running PowerShell scripts in the background. Yeah. It'll determine all kinds of things and set values and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, very interesting programming language for sure. Now, let's talk about this real briefly. I mean, in some sense, we have all this power afforded to us as developers with modern machineries, you know, modern machines, CPUs, GPUs, etc. We are very far removed from the machine itself. Mm. Like, you know, you mentioned these layers. We have layers of abstraction that take us away from the machine. Yet, at some point, it's good to come back to the machine. So I'm seeing this sort of cycle, right? We have this big emphasis on C++ now, for example, from the Microsoft perspective, because we made such an emphasis on .NET for so long.
Yeah.
And, you know, it turns out that C++ is quite useful for, like, you know, building Windows and Office and other small projects. Given all of its warts and whatever, it's still an important language to use almost directly abstracts the machine, but you get a nice high-level way of expressing what you're trying to do. What do you make of that trend of moving farther and farther away from the machine? I mean, do you think virtual machines can just obfuscate the complexity at some, like, forever? Is what I'm trying to say. I mean, that's...
Yeah. I think it's kind of necessary. I mean, part of it's to do with the scale of systems that we're trying to achieve, and the complexity of what we're trying to create. You have to build on other people's work. You cannot just, and it can't just simply be a bunch of library assembling. When people historically talked about that, it's the idea of, I will build with libraries. Actually, you need to change fundamentally. And this is why languages that were historically thought of as more script oriented have become appropriate for a number of problems, because quite frankly, so what if I save a byte? So what if I save a nanosecond? my development time just shot up by 2 months by changing language choice. The idea that I can just script some of these things in the background, and you get the example in the various build systems and bits and pieces exactly like that. The idea that I don't want to always be working at the most intimate level with the machine, because it's not efficient from programmer time. I'm not getting any bang for my buck there. It's not a good use of my time. So there's these two resources to trade off, execution time and resources, and the same from the development side of things. So this idea that we're going to push these things up, and we see this in the evolution of operating systems. What is an application in one era, or a set of layered services, optional services in one era, the next generation becomes commoditized within the operating system, so people can then build on that as a standard feature rather than actually having to make a decision about it. And a buy decision or a build decision about it. It's part of the landscape. If we're trying to build bigger systems, more and more complex, there is an inevitability to these layers. Of course, you sometimes have to cut, or somebody has to build these things. So we have this kind of wider spread. The people who are doing the tooling in the lower layers are, in some senses, further removed from the tools and the uses up at the top end. If somebody's sitting there throwing together some HTML5 and scripting little bits and pieces here, they are a world away, quite literally, from the cares and concerns of, you know, which cache is this? If I do this, is that too big for the cache line? You know, they don't have to worry about stuff like that. They're in a very different level, but they're speaking very different languages. But at the same time, we also see it in the hardware. You know, most of the stuff that we think, when they think they're programming to the machine, they're not, because there's a whole load of firmware magic that goes on beneath that. The instruction set you're coding to is not the instruction set that actually runs. You know, we've got layers within the hardware as well. So whenever people think, oh, this is close to the machine, it's like, no, it's not. You know, in C++, I don't expose There's no concept of a cache line. There's no L1 and L2 caches. There's no none of these things. The pipeline is not present. It's all done indirectly. So I think that's inevitable. The larger the systems we create, the more we need to be able to commoditize these, not just in a linkable sense, but actually a fundamental different computational model as you go up.
Absolutely. And so, you know, and I tell this to Dave all the time. It's like what we need are more events like this, where the guys who are down in that level, close to the machine, can have some sort of, you know, nice event like this, as opposed to the higher level people who program on their infrastructure.
Yeah, you know, so, it's a, you know, an event for every layer.
You know? Yes, yeah. And you know, maybe we'll create a new event called Layers, right? Right. But I think I really like the you know, and I've been pushing C++ hard. You know, people on Channel 9 know that, and I've been doing that in some sense because of how hard we push .NET, and we need balance. Mm. And there is also the notion of efficiency, right? And I want to use less electrons. That basically a battery is a container for electrons, right? Mm. I want to use less of them. And I want to be able to do a nice computation. Yeah. So the cost per electron, I think, in some sense, C++ gives me that level of efficiency versus something that has, you know, a virtual machine infrastructure on top of a virtual machine called an operating system, on top of the x86 intermediate language, which then gets transferred. So you have all these layers of virtualization in some sense. So I think, you know, that's why I'm kind of pushing that hard, because it's important to be able to have a long battery life on your phone.
Oh yeah, well, going back to where we started on the constraints, I mean, that's the constraint that I experience you know, every day. It's just, you know, this application is it's chewing up my battery life. How much time do I have between recharges?
You know,
this is kind of classic first world problem, but it's a genuine one. It influences user experience. User experience is not just the response time. You know, you have 100 milliseconds to do something, otherwise people think something's slow. That's part of it, but there's also, you know, I noticed this with the difference between my laptop and my netbook. My netbook runs forever. You know, it feels like it. You know, it just has a really good battery life. It has a lighter weight operating system. It uses less overall. It uses fewer electrons, and therefore, you know, you get generally more computation per electron. And that's the thing that makes the difference, is how often do I recharge. So this is the boundary we're pushing at the minute.
Absolutely. And then, of course, there's ARM, which is a processor that is geared towards power, management power, saving power versus hardcore compute.
Yeah.
Like its Intel cousins and AMD and whatnot. And that's going to be an interesting space to watch as those guys can duke it out.
Yeah.
And so what's the biggest problem you see in this modern world of general purpose computing? There's a nice random question.
That's
for you.
Non-trivial question.
Yeah.
Short question,
yeah.
Big answer. I don't know. Yeah. What is the biggest problem in the world of general purpose computing? Okay. Skills.
Okay.
Skills. You know, so that's the thing. That is the bottleneck. Learning is our bottleneck.
Okay.
Stuff changes rapidly. The diversification means that you can end up with two people in development who have no shared conversation. And that's always been true to some extent or another, but it's even more true now. Somebody can be 6 months behind somebody else and they have a completely in the same job and have a completely different experience of frameworks and languages and all the rest of it. There is so there is this issue of skills, but the problem is that sometimes people have a finite amount of time to devote to that. I think, first of all, it's not valued enough. I still see that as a problem in the regular workspace. Skills are the biggest differentiator in terms of project time, the ability for a project to adapt to the changing needs. That's absolutely key, and I don't think businesses appreciate that anywhere near enough. Though we see signs of increasing awareness, we're also seeing more developers. So there's more companies that involve themselves in technology, and so therefore there's even more people that didn't know. For however many people we now have that appreciate this, there's even more that don't. So that is really that kind of almost meta level of the will to learn, the desire to learn, and to appreciate that that's going to make a difference on a project. Because there's all this stuff to learn, and I think people focus on that, and they pursue the latest technology, they pursue the latest language, and yet maybe their own personal skill levels haven't moved on. They're just hopping from place to place. Mm. Or you get people who become very, very competent in a very narrow discipline, and find themselves struggling to translate that elsewhere and appreciate you know, what part of the stack they're in, if you like, or other application types. So I think that skills are the bottleneck. It's not. I don't think it is the hardware. I don't think it is the. I don't think it's the basic knowledge about how to do things. It's getting that knowledge out there. I think we know very well. We've got a set of things we know very well how to do in software development, or rather, the knowledge is all there. It's just unevenly distributed, and okay. that seems to be the big issue. That's what's holding us back.
Interesting.
It's like what William Gibson, you know, has observed. The future is already here, it's just unevenly distributed. I think that is very, very true of software. Hmm. We actually know how to develop good products that are efficient, and we know how to use the right tools. But when I say we, it's not all the same we, it's scattered around the industry. We need a way of sharing that, and that's learning, that's knowledge sharing.
Excellent, excellent, man. That's a good way to wrap this up, but that question was much too easy for you because the answer just came way too easily. But I would like to ask this. I mean, having covered Channel 9, this space for so long, I constantly see from the computer science perspective, you know, where is the, if you look at sort of the history of physics, right, you had all of these revolutions, right, and discoveries and revolutions, and we grasp these new concepts. Einstein comes along, blows everyone away. It just happens and happens and happens. It seems like in computer science, we keep going back to what we already knew in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And so what I kind of wonder is it a, have we discovered all there is to know? Or is there a fundamental problem with computer science?
Yeah, that's a hard question. I don't think we've discovered all there is to know. I think we've discovered enough that we should know better. Mm. You know, we can do better with what we, in theory, already know. I think that one of the differences, I mean, if we pick on something like physics, is that there is a sort of more readily accessible truth there, that when somebody comes up with a theory, we can say, you know, we have ways of finding out and saying that's bullshit versus that's brilliant, that works, that solves the problem. We can do that. And then that pushes enough things over into the kind of the next wave. It forms that revolution, if you like. But I don't think in software we have that. It's not the same kind of truth, if you like. It's not quite mathematics, which has its own kind of truth systems. What we're dealing with is something a little more muddled. And there's also boundary issues. What is computer science as distinct from other things that are done with computing? Some of it to some people is very, very mathematical, but if we rove around the territory, we get to some areas that are sort of more data analytics and so on, and it becomes very much a more experimental science, and the applied math side of things, the statistics side of things. And there's this constant struggle for what the identity of what it is. So I think half of that, you know, if people sort of defined computer science in one particular way, then they might say we have had revolutions and we have had some successes and so on. But I think the definition is relatively open because it's a very much an applied discipline, but without a physical without the same kind of physical coupling that something like physics would have. So I think that there is that. So it's a little slippery. Okay. That's the problem. Every time there's some kind of progress, then it gets absorbed by a redefinition, if you like, or a changing boundary.
Interesting. Right on. Well, hey, thanks for coming on Channel 9.
It's been a pleasure.
Great to talk to you. And for people watching this, you can see his keynote on the Yao website. I highly recommend you watch Cool Code. It's quite cool.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.